Hi, I'm Lynn Hutchings. I'm an architect, actually, and a social worker. And so it's kind of a weird combination, but I do research in environments for people with special needs, especially people that are aging. This study is a secondary analysis of data collected during a project funded by the Administration on Developmental Disabilities to look at the relationship between the physical environment of the home and consumers aging with developmental disabilities. One of the focal points of this secondary analysis was to explore the relationship between consumers' expectations and self-report of their own ability to do personal and household tasks around the home. This research was prompted by a convergence of a number of factors that impact people with developmental disabilities, including the increased life expectancy of this population, which has gone from 19 years old in the 30s to 66 in the 1990s. The normalization movement and the legislation beginning in the 1960s and 70s that supported and continues to support education, opportunities for, and inclusion of people with developmental disabilities into the mainstream of life. These newly founded opportunities include the deinstitutionalization movement and the trend toward community-based living prompted by the Olmsted decision's clarification that people are entitled to live in the least restrictive environment that meets their needs. The theoretical underpinning of this study, both the primary and secondary analyses, is based on the ecological theory of Lawton, developed by Lawton and Nahimo in 1973. Ecological theory of aging, sorry. Is everyone familiar with this theory, or do you want me to explain it? Okay, we'll assume you're familiar with it. Essentially, there's a zone of adaptation in that cone that says adaptive range there, in which individuals are sufficiently challenged to ensure that they will continue to find that they have the ability to adapt, so they're not so challenged or deprived that they're under pathological stress. The bottom line is that mismatches between a person and their environment can lead to situations that compromise functional ability. Secondly, I'd like to briefly summarize what the literature has to say about the role of expectations in functional ability. There's been a paucity of research in both self-expectations and self-images of people with intellectual disabilities. The reasons for the lack of research in this area have been posited to include perceived difficulties with self-report and measurement, given the cognitive and communication limitations among this population, and a preoccupation with cognitive functioning. Researchers have observed that people with intellectual disabilities often have low expectations of personal success, which can undermine and inhibit their task performance. They attribute their low expectations to attempts to complete tasks correctly that repeatedly result in failure, thereby extinguishing the expectation of success. Studies have shown that one of the consequences of a lifetime characterized by frequent confrontation with tasks that are beyond the intellectual ability of the individual is lowered motivation to achieve success. In situations perceived as challenging, it has often been observed that people with intellectual disabilities give up without trying. Repeated experiences of failure interact with cognitive, developmental, and situational factors, contributing to and confounding environmental stress. The main motivation shifts from achieving success to avoiding failure. People aging with developmental disabilities have the same challenges as any other older person. However, these age-related challenges are overlaid onto existing lifelong disabilities. It may be harder for this population to adapt to age-related disabilities due to difficulty recognizing potential hazards. They may have difficulty learning new coping strategies. They may have fewer relationships and greater isolation from typical life experiences, and they may be at higher risk for poor health due to lifestyle factors such as poor diet and lack of exercise. This study, let's get to the methods, consisted of 129 consumers, about half male and half female. Most lived in community-based homes, although about a third lived in supported and supervised apartments. Sample members were born between 1913 and 1970 and ranged in age from 32 to 91 at the time of the study. We started off by requiring that sample members be 50, but provider agencies really wanted us to take consumers who were younger because they were already experiencing the effects of aging. Developmental disability was defined according to the definition used by the federal government, which is actually a functional definition. Lifelong disabilities manifested prior to age 22, affecting daily functioning in three or more of the following areas: capacity for independent living, economic self-sufficiency, learning, mobility, receptive and expressive language, self-care, and self-direction. The sample was gathered from lists of all residential providers for adults with developmental disabilities living in the state of New Jersey. A letter explaining the study and requesting participation was sent to 129 agencies. Of those 129, 16 agreed to participate. This yielded a sample of 129 consumers. And in general, the people that were selected and that volunteered to be in the study were among the more high-functioning consumers that were available. All of the assessments were done in the consumers' homes. The assessments began with a consumer interview. Consumers were first asked some open-ended questions about their home, just to engage them. Then they were asked to rate their own abilities to complete 32 self-care tasks. The interview was followed by the researchers observing and rating consumer task performance as they undertook 61 self-care activities, which basically corresponded to the 32 questions they'd been asked about. But when we told people, ask them what to do, we had to make it more explicit, so we broke it down further. To supplement this data, 20 phone interviews were completed with direct care staff. The analysis used both qualitative and quantitative methods. Quantitative methods included multiple regression, correlations, and comparison of means. The qualitative analysis explored and explicated the findings and consumer and staff perceptions relating to functional ability and community-based living. As predicted, the two measures of functional ability were highly correlated. That is, observers and consumers agreed regarding relative magnitude of difficulty of each of the tasks. However, observers gave higher mean scores on functional ability than consumers gave themselves. That is, there was a systematic difference on absolute magnitude. This graph compares the number of subjects whose self-reported scores were higher than their observed scores, which is on the left. So you can see it's very, very few people. On the right are the 90% of consumers who underestimated their abilities when compared to observer ratings. And interestingly, when we looked at individually at what the status was of the individuals who overestimated their abilities, it was basically mostly people who had recently started using wheelchairs on a regular basis and hadn't used them before, and they were still thinking, we hypothesized that they were still thinking about their abilities that they used to have. So this was really interesting and kind of an unintuited finding. For this population, the qualitative data had a high response rate. Only one-third of consumers identified things they didn't like about their homes, although this may be because it's difficult for people to think in terms of alternatives to what they know. The qualitative data not only elucidated the quantitative findings, it also allowed the researcher to go beyond mere functional ability and look at involvement and engagement in the life of the home and community. Consumers describe the same age-related issues as people in the general population. But again, these were overlaid on pre-existing disabilities. These are the issues that were most often identified by consumers and staff as impacting on people's interactions and behaviors. And I could write an article on each one of these, but I don't have time to go into them now. Consumers were most likely not to participate in kitchen activities where the risk was perceived to be too high, opening and closing windows, and doing laundry-related activities. Some of the reasons why consumers didn't do these things included lack of self-confidence. Consumers were afraid that their actions could have dramatically bad consequences. One man, when asked to put a tape in the video player, refused, saying he didn't want to blow the house up. Similarly, consumers expressed concerns that turning on the stove could burn the house down, or that burning oneself with the iron was almost inevitable. Another reason for not undertaking an activity was lack of previous opportunity. Some tasks, such as using a wall switch to turn on a light, it was obvious that consumers had never tried. We'd walk into a room and I would ask them to turn on a light, and they would kind of look at me chagrined and then try every light switch and were delighted when a light finally came on. Another reason was lack of person-environment fit. As an example, in some homes where older residents had arthritis or limited hand dexterity, lights were controlled by the small little rotary switches on the light stem that were impossible for consumers to manipulate. The same consumers, however, could easily have toggled a switch. Another reason was habitual reliance on staff. And this was one thing that the staff interviews revealed, that consumers weren't expected to do numerous activities just because the staff were in the habit of doing things for consumers. One consumer told us when we asked him if he could turn on a light from his bed, he said he didn't have a light by his bed, he just had a pull cord. This person could have pulled a cord to turn on a light as well as to call the staff, but the environment didn't give him that option. This study found, really, that despite all the legislation and intention of increasing self-determination and autonomy for people with developmental disabilities, the reality is that on a day-to-day basis, people are not encouraged to be as self-sufficient as they can be. They are discouraged by built environments that do not offer the needed support and by staff who may be likely to do things for consumers instead of teaching them to do for themselves. So there's a need to create environments that allow positive interactions between individuals and their social and physical environments. We learn judgment by taking risks. Typically, developing people have lots of opportunities to take risks and learn judgment. But I'm wondering, looking at the results of this study, if people with developmental disabilities have opportunities to learn judgment. Understandably, risk avoidance strategies are often utilized when working with people with developmental disabilities. We live in a litigious society. When accidents happen, we look to see who's to blame. However, if physical environments were safer and more conducive to independence, this could reduce risk, increase consumer confidence, and improve functional ability. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
In doing this study, because you solicited participation from a lot of agencies,
mm-hmm.
and in light of your last point about opportunity, how did you account for agency philosophy in terms of some agencies take very much a deficit perspective when dealing with individuals, and other agencies take more of a capacity perspective?
The agency philosophy was there, mm-hmm. and in both situations. And a lot of times the actually the people who we set up this whole interview procedure with were surprised by the results. And during part of the study, we had funding from a local agency to actually go into the home and make changes to make the home more conducive to independence. And when the people who ran the agency found out that the consumers were actually not cooking and not doing these things, they were taken aback by this. So it was just a really what a lot of times what the agency thought was happening was not filtering down to the direct care staff. So, sure. Anything else? Yes.
Rohan Realize from Palo Alto, California. I appreciate what you did. Very helpful policy implications too. But I'm wondering from the perspective of some of your conclusions, if given your sample, if you can go so far to say that the challenge with the representativeness of the sample and making this the conclusion that maybe they're not receiving sufficient opportunities or they are underestimated. And given that you're working with, your sample was specifically on those who are higher functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So we work primarily with the lower end of the spectrum. And research like this has dramatic effects on the community when we made such broad generalizations.
Well, I'm not generalizing to people with probably IQs below 50, because I would say most of the 118 of the 129 people in our sample were able to participate in a discussion. And so that tells you something about who it would be generalizable to. Okay?